Welcome to Conspiracy with your host, Earl Benazet, and my special guest this evening, Dr. Bruce Maccabee. I met Dr. Maccabee at St. Louis MUFON Symposium, along with Linda Mountain-Howe. They were at one particular table. I'm not sure if he had spoken yet. And I was always interested in his research. He'd done some very thorough research in a number of different UFO topics. Dr. Maccabee received a BS in physics at Worcester Polytech Institute in Worcester, Massachusetts, and then at American University in Washington, D.C., an MS and PhD in physics. In 72, he began his career at the Naval Ordnance Laboratory, White Oak, Silver Spring, Maryland, which later became the Naval Surface Warfare Center, Dahlgreen Division. Dr. Maccabee retired from the government service in 2008, and he's worked on optical data processing, generation of underwater sound with lasers, and various aspects of the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, and the Ballistic Missile Defense, BMD, using high-power lasers. His UFO research and investigations, which he often stresses are completely unrelated to his Navy work, of course, the Kenneth Arnold sighting in June 1947, it occurred then, the McMinnville, Oregon, Trent photos of 1950, Gemini 11 astronaut photos, September 1966, New Zealand sightings, December 1978, Japan Airlines sighting of November 1986. Is that the same one that John Callahan speaks of?
Yes, it is.
Great. That's, of course, most people know if you've watched the Disclosure Project briefing. He was the first gentleman to speak, head of the FAA, Investigations Division, retired. And there's a number of other cases, Ed Walters, others in Gulf Breeze, Red Bubba sightings, 1990-1992, Mexico City, video of August 1997, Phoenix Lights, March 13, 1997, and recently he's been involved in the checking out the China issue, China sightings. Well, welcome, Dr. Maccabee. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I was wondering if there's any particular incident that sticks in your mind that was the most fascinating or really kind of blew your mind in a sense, which is might be hard to do, but.
Well, I guess one of the most surprising sightings, most important ones that I worked on was the New Zealand case in December 1978. Mm-hmm. Since you asked for sightings that were important, this is the only one that I'm aware of that has been argued in the refereed technical press in a magazine called Applied Optics. I managed to get a letter to the editor describing one particular incident of many incidents that occurred during the New Zealand sightings. We're talking about December 31st, 1978, when a freighter aircraft with a pilot and co-pilot and a news crew consisting of a reporter, a sound reporter, and a cameraman, five people were on board this aircraft. And they saw strange things happening, lights out in the sky as they were traveling along at an hour, 2 hours after midnight on December 31st, 1978. They saw these things and filmed them. They were picked up on radar. There were two tape recordings made, one at the Wellington Air Traffic Control Center and one on the airplane by the reporter. Probably one of the most, a UFO case with some of the most data available. You can practically reconstruct the site based on, reconstruct the sighting based on what data we have obtained from interviews and from the air traffic control center tape and the recording tape made on the plane.
Great.
So the point is, as far as importance is concerned, I managed to get a letter to the editor into this Applied Optics magazine describing the brightness of this object. And then there was a letter rebutting my article saying that all I did was film a Japanese squid boat that was in the area at the time. And I was able to get another rebuttal to the rebuttal, point out that there was no evidence, even though such said squid boats were supposed to report where they were fishing, there was no evidence of a squid boat there, and nobody had ever seen one there, and so on. This becomes very technical, but that's three letters to the editor which contain technical details about the sighting. Three letters to the editor about that one case, and so far as I know, even 30 years later, that's the only case that's been argued out in the refereed press.
Wow, that's a shame.
Well, it was hard enough to get that in. You know, the reason that I managed to get a letter in was because in November of 1978, Applied Optics published an article which I call A Buggy UFO Hypothesis. On the front cover of the magazine, they showed an insect impaled on a high voltage electrode with corona coming off the antennae and appendages of the insect. Mm-hmm. And the article, article written by two entomologists, mm-hmm. insect people who study insects. One of them had read a book called The Utah UFO Display by Frank Salisbury, written in the early 70s, and about UFO sightings in the Uintah Basin of Utah. And there have been a number of people who saw these big glowing objects. And so the Callahan and Mencken, two men who wrote the article that appeared in Applied Optics, argued that perhaps there were swarms of insects flying along, and there was a cloud overhead that was electrified, sort of like impending thunderstorm, but there really wasn't a thunderstorm. It was just, there's all of a big electric field in the atmosphere anyway. So their argument was that maybe bugs flying through this electric field were having corona come off their appendages, and if you have enough bugs, you get a bright enough display to think you're looking at some object which is glowing.
Sounds a little bit of a stretch.
Well, it was a little bit of a stretch, but you know, the general press and the scientific community like anything that, quote, debunks, unquote, UFOs. Mm-hmm. So this article there was a featured article in this particular last issue in November, the first issue in December of Applied Optics. I forget exactly which issue it was, but it was featured and even made it onto CBS News with Walter Cronkite. He interviewed one of the authors of this article and played up the idea that could the UFOs be simply, at least some of the sightings be simply insects that are glowing in the atmosphere because of electric field. Well, I read that article and I noticed there were a couple of things wrong with it, more than just a couple, but a couple that were technical. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a rebutting letter to the editor. The editor said, okay, I had done this within 2 weeks of the article being published. I said, I sent a letter to the editor. The editor then sent me a letter saying, I will wait to see if there are any more responses and then publish all the responses at once. Hmm. So there was nothing to do but wait. In the meantime, at the end of December of 1978, along comes the New Zealand case. And that included, as I pointed out before, a color movie film, which was loaded with images of this thing, which I could use to calculate its brightness. And so, after weeks of investigation of the New Zealand sightings, and I actually went to New Zealand to interview witnesses, in New Zealand and Australia to interview witnesses to the sighting, first of all, tried to get an article on the New Zealand case into Nature magazine. Nature had carried a short article about the sightings a day or so after they happened and basically said that it was probably mirages or something like that. They didn't really know. Well, I thought maybe Nature would be willing to publish an article that was based on a real investigation as opposed to just some guesswork. Mm-hmm. I was wrong.
Uh-oh.
April, I sent a letter to the editor of Nature, along with my article, and they rejected it, saying they thought that it should be part of a more comprehensive discussion. Well, wow. When I got rejected there, about the same time I got a letter from the editor of Applied Optics, saying that the editor said, well, I haven't gotten any more responses to the buggy UFO article. So therefore, I will publish yours, providing you shorten it and all that sort of stuff. Typical editor always wants it shorter than whatever you want. So I decided to see if I could pull a bait and switch, in a sense.
Oh, we've got to take a break, Bruce. I'm sorry to cut you off. We'll be back in just about 2 minutes with Conspiracy, and Bruce will continue this interesting discussion here. So stay tuned, folks.
What is this?
This is the Desert Heat. KDHS, Desert Hot Springs, California.
Are you in a band or know somebody who is? Looking for radio play?
Go to MusicSubmit.com.
MusicSubmit.com is a band's best friend. You can submit your music to radio stations, online music magazines, online music directories, blogs, podcasts, and indie record labels. Go to MusicSubmit.com and create your own artist account. Upload your songs, pictures, links, and videos. Then submit yourself for free to any site you want. Check out their submission packages. This is huge. Go to MusicSubmit.com right now.
The number one source of rock and talk radio. Rock and talk radio. Here on STRN Radio. Here on STRN Radio.
Well, we're back with Conspiracy and my special guest, Dr. Bruce Makovic. Why don't you continue where you were, sir? That was really interesting.
Yes, well, as I was saying, because of the buggy UFO article being published and featured in Applied Optics, I wrote a letter to the editor rebutting part of the technical data that was published in that article. Mm-hmm. The editor said he wanted to wait, see if there are any more responses, and so he waited. In the meantime, on December 31st, 1978, New Zealand sightings occurred, and I investigated them, and in about March, wrote an article and tried to get an article into Nature. Nature rejected my article. But about the same time, I got a letter from the editor of Applied Optics saying, well, he'd be willing to publish something that I had written, but I should shorten my response. So I decided to see if I could pull a bait and switch, sort of. and I said, instead of writing a rebutting article about the buggy UFO hypothesis, how about I sent him an article. I said, how about this article, which fits right in with Applied Optics because it makes use of technical data in cameras and film, mm-hmm. and radar distances and so on, calculate brightness of an object that was out there that was seen by these people. And so in other words, it was an optical calculation, mm-hmm. that was featured in this letter. And the editor said he liked that idea better, and he said something like he was sure glad he didn't have to explain what was seen, and he made some comment about how UFO people interested in UFOs are 99 and 44 100% kooks.
Great. So, makes you feel wonderful, I know.
So you can see where he was coming from.
Yeah, definitely.
At any rate, he did publish my article, which came out in August of 1979, and as I mentioned before, some people wrote another letter to the editor claiming that my brightness calculation was okay, but what the people saw was their description of an object that was moving as fast as their aircraft, or maybe even faster. Nevertheless, rebutting my letter said that what was seen was a squid fishing boat. And I might wonder what the squid fishing have to do with bright lights in the sky.
Yeah, I just isn't that a different plane? You know, as far as existence.
Well, the boats from the Japanese squid fleet, in this case, fishing off the coast of New Zealand, they use very bright lights to lure the squid up to the surface so that they can net squid during the nighttime. In other words, a 24/7 operation. Mm-hmm.
But here the lights are facing down into the water, right? And now you're seeing, in some way, seeing lights in the sky, and this is supposed to be the same thing. I love it.
These naked 10,000 watt bulbs, and you might have 20 or 30 of these bulbs, you can have one boat looking like the brightness of a small city. But mm-hmm. of course, it's sitting on the ocean.
Yeah.
And it's essentially stationary, you know, it's not moving at tens or hundreds of miles per hour. I was able to rebut the argument in a third letter to the editor. So there are three letters to the editor, and as I pointed out, case is important because it's still the only one that's been argued out in the refereed press.
Wow.
As far as the quote propaganda war unquote between UFO investigators and skeptics is concerned, mm-hmm. skeptics still won. because I never had any response to those articles.
Wow.
Well, very little. A couple of people may have responded, but basically it was ignored.
Kind of like dead silence.
The editor actually allowed me to publish in my third rebuttal that this was an extremely bright light and it was unidentified. So I have published a refereed article that, in fact, indicates that there was some unidentified light flying around, but nobody paid any attention to it, as far as I can tell.
What a shame.
There was far more attention paid to, for example, the 1986 Japan Airlines case, Japan mm-hmm. Airlines 1628.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had trouble to refute that, wouldn't they, if there's... you know, air radar, air-to-air radar, ground-to-air radar, the jet that he was supposedly talking to, I believe, the pilot. And it wasn't it that an object was seen at a certain angle, and then a number of seconds later, here it is, a couple of hundred miles away, and then again, it's kind of like doing a circle around it. Was that true? Did I have that right?
Are you talking about the Japan Airlines case?
Yeah. Is that true?
That was November 16th of 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Almost exactly 20 years before the 2000 or the 2006 O'Hare Airport one.
Yeah, which is just air turbulence, they call it? Or
it was published in January of 2007, I should say. Mm-hmm. The O'Hare Airport case was published in January 2007. But that's just an interesting temporal coincidence.
Got a question.
1986, mm-hmm. Going back to 1986, with the Japan Airlines case, you had a situation where this jumbo 747 aircraft was flying from Reykjavik, Iceland to, Fairbanks, Alaska, Anchorage, Alaska,
mm-hmm.
And then it would go from Anchorage to Japan. But on this leg of the trip from Reykjavik to, Anchorage,
mm-hmm.
an airplane entered United States airspace, the northern, northeastern corner of Alaska, and the pilot noticed that there were some lights traveling around in the vicinity of his aircraft, and he assumed that they were Air Force jets, because they weren't far from the Soviet Union at that point. And the Soviet Union, back in those days, would be sending jets over our territory to see what sort of response there would be, and we would do the same thing for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At any rate, they basically ignored these things that were moving around, assuming they were jet aircraft. Then all of a sudden, as they're traveling in a straight line southwestward, I should say, they're traveling in a straight line. They've contacted they've contacted Anchorage Air Force Base and said that they're in Anchorage Air Force Base, or rather, Anchorage, Alaska airspace. And then all of a sudden, two objects appeared right in front of the aircraft, according to the pilot, the co-pilot, and the flight engineer.
Mm-hmm.
These two things are quite complicated to describe. Like, they seemed to have flames coming out the back, and they were tilting left and right, and of course they were traveling at 600 and some miles an hour, the same speed as the jet. The pilot said he felt heat on his face.
As they came close,
he tried to take a picture, but his camera wouldn't work. And then these two things suddenly disappeared, and then the men started looking around the aircraft to see if they could see where these things went. They spent 2 minutes in an orientation of one above the other, and then like 10 minutes of an orientation side by side, then they disappeared.
Hmm.
And the pilot then saw a glowing light off of the left-hand side, turned on the airplane radar, and got a large target way out there. And then as he flew along, he looked back, he's looking out the left-hand side window. He doesn't have a very good view to the back, but he looks as far to the left as he can. And he saw what he described as a silhouette of a gigantic spaceship. And
wow.
He asked for permission to descend from his 36,000 foot altitude or whatever it was. And he was given that permission. Now, I just say this period of time has taken up 20 minutes worth of plane time, I guess. during which time he's been communicating with Anchorage Air Route Traffic Control Center. All those communications are on tape, so you can go back and reconstruct the flight in terms of the incidents at the various times that they occurred.
Yeah, I remember him saying it was on videotape, it was on, they had the voice tapes, he had the target printouts from 1991 tax returns that he found. Went on. I got one question for you. When you say people see it disappear, is it possible, since we know that you probably know about the 1996 occurrence on STS-75, is it possible that the craft, these objects, can turn themselves into ultraviolet X-ray or gamma energy and hence become invisible that way to us?
Well, to convert, turn into X-ray energy or something like that, or to go the other way and become heat, as a physicist, that doesn't make much sense to me. I don't know how that something like that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
You could have a situation where they turn their lights off.
Right.
Or you could have a situation where they have such a huge acceleration that they get out of your line of sight in a, what I call a twinkling of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
If something can move fast enough, you can't follow it. It's going to be
reason,
just like
you know, the reason why I say that is, you know, abductions. People talk about, well, they see a blue light, and then all of a sudden they're paralyzed and they're taken right through the roof, right through a window, right through the side of a ship without a door. Somehow they must be changing our mass. And if they can change our mass, that means they can change their mass, and then hence doing an end run around Einstein's theory that says mass becomes so humongous as you approach the speed of light that you then need all the power in the universe to push yourself past it, like a catch-22, you know. People are, some scientists are saying, non-mainstream scientists, of course, saying that it's possible that if they can convert themselves somehow and their craft into ultraviolet, X-ray, and gamma and have almost no mass, that they could go physically through a star, through a moon, through a planet, and physically go from one end of our galaxy to the other almost instantaneously. Because you could go at that speed, you could go 6 trillion times the speed of light. Who would care if the mass didn't bother you? You know, I know that sounds kind of far out, and you're a physicist, and you'd probably shrug at that.
Photons don't have mass, and they get stuck at the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, you'd convert yourself into photons, and you'd be traveling at the speed of light. But there is a difference, which is the time dilation, or the slowdown of time effect,
mm-hmm.
that traveling at the speed of light. You wouldn't notice that there was any time passing at all. You'd go from point A to point B, and by the time you get to point B, you'd be just as old as you were at point A.
Wow.
How you get to convert yourself into photons or whatever, and
who knows, right? Yeah.
Transmit it and travel as fast as speed as light, or somehow go faster, or I don't know. But we have the descriptions of things happening, which are very strange.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, the so-called description of solid light, where people talk about beams coming out of these objects, a beam that will protrude out to a certain distance and end.
Yeah, how do you do that?
Certainly not light in any ordinary light beam thing.
Mm-hmm.
But let me say a little bit more about this Japan Airlines case, because it has been featured in a number of disclosure press releases and so on.
Right.
Because John Callahan has come forward and tried to give his version of what happened. I was able to get a hold of the radar printouts, and I was able to get a hold of a copy of the Air Traffic Control Center tape, and I just could reconstruct the whole flight. And I published that. It's on my website. I published it first way back in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
Spring of 87, International UFO Reporter. But it's on, the complete article is on my website.
Why don't you give us your website? What is that, actually?
www.brumac.8k.com.
Cool.
Brumac.8k.com.
I'm sure folks will want to look at that.
It's got a lot of case analyses on there, and other studies and interesting stuff, and even music. So anyway, look, if you read the article, you'll find out what happened sort of on a minute-by-minute basis And as I said, it began with these two objects, one above the other, that suddenly reoriented themselves to be side by side, very complex structures of lights and darkness and so on. Mm-hmm. The pilot was, as he approached Fairbanks, Alaska, and saw what he referred to as a silhouette of a gigantic spacecraft, asked to descend, and the air traffic controller said, okay, descend and also make a turn. Turn completely around and see if you can see what's behind you. And it was during that turn that Elmendorf Air Force Base claimed they had what they call a flight of two. That is, they were detecting the airplane's radar reflection and a reflection from something else. But the plane, now you got to realize this plane is a very cumbersome thing. It does not turn on a dime. Mm-hmm. It turns on a silver dollar, maybe. And so by the time the plane got around, they didn't see anything. Eventually the plane landed at Anchorage, and the pilot was interviewed right off the bat by FAA people, Federal Aviation Administration people. Mm-hmm. And that was in November of 1986. Nobody would have ever heard about that if it hadn't been for the fact when these pilots got to Japan, they apparently started talking about the case. The pilots were impressed by the fact that they were told that radar had detected something. So they told their story to some Japanese press. An American correspondent in Japan saw this story, called up the public information officer at the Anchorage Air Force Base, Anchorage, Alaska, and was told that yes, this thing did happen. So this reporter wrote an article that was published throughout the United States. And there was such a big flap over this particular case that the FAA announced it was going to investigate. The only case the FAA has investigated up until the one 20 years later in O'Hare Airport. Mm-hmm. The FAA investigated that.
Which is just a weather anomaly, as I said, which yeah, I laugh at that.
It's a weather anomaly. I love about stupid.
Yeah, stupid is as stupid does, as the movie said.
In the case of the Japan Airlines in 1986, the FAA says that they're going to investigate. Now, after about 4 weeks, the quote answer was published by SICOP, the Committee for Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, which is now just called CSI. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Mainly the work of Philip Klass.
Oh boy.
Late Philip Klass, who was the world's greatest debunker, I guess.
Just a poo-pooer himself.
And he said that yes, indeed, there were extraterrestrial things involved in the Japan Airlines case. It was Mars and Jupiter. To which I responded, well, Mars and Jupiter were in the sky at bright spots, you know, like you see the planets. And they weren't directly ahead of the aircraft. They were off to the side somewhere. Mm-hmm. But even then, one of the key things that the pilot and his men had reported was that these things appeared, first of all, one above the other, and then all of a sudden they reoriented to be side by side. And I pointed out it would take Mars and Jupiter a hell of a long time to go from being one above the other. Being side by side.
Exactly. Yep.
So after all that, a couple of months later, SICOP came up with another explanation that it was moonlight on clouds.
Oh, we got to take another break here, so hold that thought, and we'll be back with Dr. Bruce McAbee, and it gets more interesting every minute. Hold on, folks, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes with Conspiracy.
You're listening to the Desert Heat. KDHS, Desert Hot Springs, California.
Let me tell you about a place that you wanna go to, where fantasy and guilty pleasures all come true. His name is Fender and he's the king of the green room, with McLovin in the oven with all his tattoos. It's the
Den of Sin.
Don't you wanna come in?
Den of Sin.
Let the madness begin.
Den of Sin.
pay the price. It's the
den of sin.
Don't you wanna come in?
Den of sin.
Friend
of sin.
Don't you wanna come in?
Den of sin.
Let the madness begin.
It's the den of sin.
With the big old grin.
Den of sin.
Bring your sister and a friend. Yeah.
The number one source of rock and talk radio. STRN Radio. STRN Radio.
Well, we're back with Conspiracy and your host, Earl Benezet, and my special guest, Dr. Bruce McAbee. Dr. McAbee, I wanted to ask you, we mentioned a little bit about China, but could you go into more detail about what happened back there just recently in July?
Yeah, July 7th, a few weeks ago, there was an airport in China that was shut down because of a UFO. Apparently, some pilots saw a light over the airport. I guess they must have told the air traffic controllers, I guess they saw something. There's no report of radar detection. But for whatever reason, whatever they saw, convinced them that they should shut down the airport for safety's sake. They didn't know what was going on. And that's not a simple thing to do. You don't do it lightly because you could be a dozen flights that suddenly get have to divert to other airports. And that has this rippling effect on the whole air traffic control situation in China, in this case.
Or if they have enough fuel, they can circle, I suppose. But.
Well, I suppose, I don't know, probably some of them did circle, but you know, it turned out to be for an hour.
Wow. Yeah.
That the airport was shut down, so you don't know if you can circle for an hour. Anyway, they came out in the press. Now, this is in Hangzhou, China, not far from Shanghai. And it's a major 5 or 6 million people live there as a big international airport. And the news story came out that the airport had been shut down. The initial news stories in Chinese and then translated into English. The airport had been shut down because of something hovering over the airport. And the story came out saying that nobody knew exactly what it was, but they knew the details of the shutdown at any rate. Lasted about an hour. Well, as these news stories came up, many of them were accompanied by photographs, one or more photographs, or a video.
Wow.
Stories about this event, because it involved the shutdown of a major airport, stories about this event have been continuous since July 7th.
Wow.
And even ABC News apparently did a story on it. Nobody really knows what's going on, but it seemed that the press managed to find photographs to associate with, now notice I use the term associate with, the event. So in other words, you have the official Chinese press talking about some lighted object that was seen over the airport, but no known photographs of the object itself. At least the government didn't say there were any photographs. Nevertheless, the news stories include photographs.
Wow.
And on my website, www.brumac.8k.com, the first sighting analysis and a whole list of sighting analyses that I've put on my website over the years, but the first one now is the analysis of four photographs that have been associated with the airport shutdown. This has been a subject of discussion as recently as, you know, within the last few days as to what these photographs show. Does any one of these photographs actually show what was over the airport, or do they have nothing to do with the airport? Well, my own analysis of these four photographs is that they are aircraft, man-made aircraft. Three of the pictures appear to show beams coming down. Now, the reason they seem strange is because what you see is a horizontal or roughly horizontal line of very bright light. And for example, you take the first photograph, which shows buildings lit with a yellow glow. And up in the sky is this line of light with what looks like a filmy fan beam of radiation coming down from it. And when I saw that picture, my first thought was, well, this is nighttime and it's a time exposure. That's why the buildings appear to be so bright. You can see shadows caused by lighting and the color of sodium vapor lights and so on. And because it was a time exposure, I knew that if there had been an airplane up in the sky that was moving along with its headlights on or a searchlight beam, whatever, then you would create a streak, a line image on the film or on the focal plane. And this line image would not look at all like what the object itself is. It would look like just a line of light. And so you get an overexposed line of light in every one of these pictures. The first picture appears to have a searchlight beam pointing downward, making the fan beam of whitish light that's protruding down from this bright line. Second picture has a horizontal bright line and a beam that seems to shoot off to the front, to the left end of this line, which is an ordinary airliner with its headlights on. And the third picture shows a horizontal line of light with beams coming down, and same sort of thing for the fourth picture. What I concluded was all four pictures show police helicopter type of thing or an ordinary aircraft. Police helicopter for 1, 3, and 4, and then maybe an ordinary aircraft for number 2.
Well, can you hold on 1 second?
They're presented on my website, along with some links to some presentations by other people. The bottom line, I guess, is, although I will say one more thing that was associated with the sighting is a video which shows a light moving through the sky with curved beams going from trailing behind it as it travels along. Apparently a Russian rocket launch. And the first photo on my website story about this Chinese case.
Uh-huh.
First photo has been identified as being taken in 2007 in France of a police helicopter. So what amounts to is the story came out in the press. It's been associated with a lot of pictures that have nothing to do with the actual story itself, and that makes me wonder, is there a big disinformation campaign going on? Because
to muddle the issue, yeah.
On the one hand, the Chinese government is saying, well, we had an unknown something or other up above the airport, and it was of sufficient importance to us that we actually shut down the airport. But on the other hand, when the press released the stories, they released the stories with photos that have nothing to do with the event, and they're easy to debunk. There's the key right there.
Mm-hmm.
Information becomes easily debunkable. Well, people over the airport don't know what a police helicopter looks like. You know,
wouldn't you say that's similar to when you have a crop circle and then they came in and the government came in and put some metal filings in here or some kind of other strange stuff to confuse the crop circle researchers? It's kind of the same thing. They just want to be able to debunk it, you know.
Well, that may be. I don't know. But the press is not scot-free here either.
Mm-hmm.
They're not Mr. Clean. The press likes to have some illustration to go along with the story. Mm-hmm. So for some reason or other, they've apparently grabbed onto these pictures that have nothing to do with the story and published them with a story anyway.
Sure.
I don't really know what's going on. a lot of this UFO business. If you look at consider the O'Hare Airport case that occurred in November of 2006, as I said, it was almost exactly 20 years after the Japan Airlines case. But in November 2006, we had the O'Hare Airport case where several people at the airport, employees of the airport,
mm-hmm.
saw a circular grayish object that was hovering over the airport, hovering over one of the sea gate or something like that of United Airlines. And all of a sudden it went right straight up and punched a hole in the clouds. And the FAA investigated because this was involved airport employees and an event over an airport. So the FAA first of all said, it was probably lights on the ground reflected from the clouds, which makes no sense since this thing was described as a grayish disc silhouetted against the cloud cover, not a bright light silhouette against a cloud cover. And when that didn't work, the FAA said, well, we think it was some weather anomaly. Not being specific as to what weather anomaly would look like a disk if you go up through and punch a hole through the cloud. Now, is this because why do they even approach, why do they even make a claim as silly as they did? What they should have done, basically what they should have done to retain some credibility was say, well, we don't know. Or maybe it didn't happen, and try to debunk the thing that way, claiming that the witnesses were crazy. But to come up with an explanation, which is just plain silly, it's like, it's a long history of that going back into the...
Yeah, but unfortunately, a lot of people don't look at it like you do or I do. They don't investigate it, and they just say, oh, well, that's what they said. Well, that must be what it is.
Right.
Which is a shame.
The New Zealand case that I spent some time discussing before, we managed to get into Applied Optics magazine. That's on my website as well, and all sorts of technical details and gory details about how whatever this thing was, it wasn't a squid boat, but there were numerous explanations offered immediately. When this happened between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. on December 31st, 1978, the early morning paper in Christchurch, New Zealand had a headline saying, witnesses saw the planet Venus. And then somebody pointed out to the, oh, that was an astronomer, says witnesses see planet Venus. Then somebody pointed out that, oh, by the way, the sighting occurred before Venus was up over the horizon.
It's on the other side of the Earth.
Somebody said, oh, well, in that case, he thought it was Jupiter. Now, the Jupiter explanation didn't make any sense either, because Jupiter was up, it was right overhead, and the cameraman would have had to film looking straight up through the top of the aircraft, metal top, in order to film Jupiter.
I love
it. That didn't make any sense either. Then there are numerous other explanations, like the light reflected off of breasts of mating mutton birds.
Isn't there a book in which, I don't know if it's Keyhole or somebody, has in the foreword about some ladies getting burned with radiation? I think it might have been that thing. Was it the one around Pennsylvania? The one that looked like a large nut, followed by helicopters? And then somebody tried to push it off and say it was the planet Venus. And the author of the book, I forgot who it was, said, well, it's the first time the planet Venus came down and radiated somebody.
I don't recall that. You may be right. I don't specifically recall it. But certainly, Venus is the world's most popular UFO.
Yep.
There is no doubt, absolutely can be proven, that Venus has been, people have failed to recognize what Venus is.
True.
In the early morning, in particular, when the sky, when the air is nice and clear, when Venus is at its brightest, rising about an hour and a half or 2 hours before the sun, it's so bright it almost makes shadows.
But it doesn't make right angle turns at 5 or 10,000 miles an hour either.
Right angle turns, but a lot of people have attributed to Venus things like motions back and forth and up and down and so on. Whenever a sighting like that lasts for a long period of time, though, you begin to wonder if it could be astronomical. I remember a guy who was videotaping Venus at night. He came out of his work at 7:30, 8 o'clock one night, and he sees this very bright light off in the west, so bright that it has to be close by. So he ran and got his camera, and he videotaped it over a period of, half an hour or something like that, where part of the time the light was continually going down and down and down low on the horizon, and it was going behind branches of trees. And I could see, he called me up the next day, said, I got this amazing video. I don't know if it was a half an hour, an hour long, or 2 hours, I forget. But the UFO was there for such a long time, and he was able to videotape the whole thing. And I said, okay, my first guess before he even described it was on the tape was that he had misidentified Venus. But then I got he sent me a copy of his tape, his videotape. And I could see where he would freak out, because when Venus goes behind a cloud, behind a branch of a tree, if it's not focused, it makes extremely unusual looking images, and it's not likely to be focused because he had his cam on automatic focus. And when you do that and you go out in the dark and try to take a focused picture of a bright light up in the sky, it just doesn't work. The camera will zoom in and zoom out or go through focus and create blurred images. You have to go to manual focus and set it at infinity if you want to try to videotape or photograph something that is a distant light at night. So anyway, bottom line is, this guy had spent an hour, however long it was, videotaping Venus without realizing it. I told him to go out the next night and see if he could see it again. And sure enough, he did. So, in his own mind, that was solved.
All right. Hey, one for the Gipper.
All right.
Well, let's see. We've got to cut off in about 20-30 seconds. We have about 7 minutes to wrap up. Do you have any books you're writing? Any particular?
I have a book that I wrote. Two books, actually. The UFO-FBI Connection that was no longer available. And a book called Abduction in My Life, which is available for me. The Abduction in My Life book is unique in the way of in its construction. Probably no other book quite like it because there's a fact book built inside a novel. Mm-hmm. And anybody who wants a copy of that, you can learn something about it from my website. Right at the very beginning of the website, I talk about the book somewhat. And you can contact me and I can tell you more.
Okay. Well, here we go for a break, and we'll be back in a couple minutes with Conspiracy with my special guest, Dr. Bruce Maccabee. Stay tuned.
We're really going to rock it.
We're rocking you hard. Rocking you robin. KDHS. Desert Hot Springs. It's California.
The changes in the world today are moving faster than ever before. And it's good to know there's someone who can help keep it all in perspective. Psychic medium and paranormal life consultant and renowned author Rick Hayes can help you get through these tough times. Through prayer, faith, and guidance, Rick Hayes can take you on a path to acknowledge the appreciation of life's gift. Amazing and very real, the best at what he does, states the producers of the highly acclaimed film, The Possessed. Rick Hayes, founder of Life's Gift Incorporated, offers personal as well as group consultations. As a renowned and well-respected speaker, Rick is available to appear at your next event. For more information, go to www.lifesgift.com. Rick Hayes, living life supernaturally.
Well, we're back with Conspiracy. Your host, Earl Benazet, with my guest tonight, Dr. Bruce Maccabee. Any conspiracy type issues you'd like to talk about?
Well, anybody who has paid any attention to the UFO subject over the years knows that quote conspiracy unquote has reared its ugly head as a possibility over and over again. But to some extent, this may depend on whether you consider government policy to be a conspiracy. You can define it maybe as some government policy to be a conspiracy against the people or whatever. I tend to think of it more just that government trying to CYA, cover your rear end.
Mm-hmm.
You go way back into the ancient history. I wrote a book called UFO-FBI Connection, published about 10 years ago. It's no longer available except used copies on Amazon or other places. The UFO-FBI Connection was an attempt to show what the FBI had learned about Air Force activities back in the late 40s and early 50s. Now, believe it or not, the FBI did investigate UFO sightings then in the summer of 1947, and they filed them under the classification Security Matter-X. In other words, there really was an X-file, guys. But they stopped investigating about the end of the summer of 1947, and that acted like a black hole, absorbing information from the Air Force but not releasing it to anybody. Back in those days, no one ever thought that the Freedom of Information Act would occur. No, it didn't even cross anybody's mind that these top secret documents would ever make it to the light of day. But the, in 1975, the Congress passed the Freedom of Information Act, and that allowed us to request documents. And in 1976, I sent a letter to the FBI asking for information, and 6 or 7 months later, I got 1,600 pages of stuff from the FBI, which up to that point, nobody had ever known the FBI was even involved. But by combining Air Force intelligence documents and documents from Project Blue Book, Project Sign, Project Grudge, and Project Blue Book, and looking at the ancient history, what's now ancient history of the UFO subject, I concluded the reason the Air Force, well, a reason anyway, that the Air Force didn't admit that there was really something going on, didn't admit publicly there was something going on, was because they had no control over it.
Makes sense. Yeah.
They didn't know what they could do about it. In the FBI file, there are a couple of documents that make it clear that top Air Force people were seriously considering the interplanetary hypothesis. That's almost a quote out of one of the FBI documents, that top Air Force officials are considering, seriously considering the possibility of interplanetary craft.
I would think it would be so much more acceptable if they would have just said it and gotten it out, you know, into the public, and then maybe done, you know, research along with the public, and we wouldn't be in this quandary.
Well, yeah, if they had owned up to it at first.
Yeah.
What they did was they essentially built up a tradition that there's nothing to UFOs. Right from the very beginning in 1947, Kenneth Arnold's sighting, June 24th, 1947, published in June 25th, 1947. Kenneth Arnold thought he was seeing some new type of aircraft. No sooner was his sighting published than other people started coming forward with things that they saw, sometimes weeks or months before, and sometimes just the previous day. Mm-hmm. And by the time of early July happened, of course, you have the Roswell case, and that sort of stands off by its own. But all the sightings of by people and things in the sky, there are well over 1,000 reports in local papers throughout the United States about people seeing things flying through the sky. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be there.
And then you have that 1951 article talking about how the Air Force agreed to poo-poo UFOs and anybody talking about it, they were going to discredit them.
Well, in 1947, the Air Force immediately said, it's not ours. And there's nothing we're doing that explains these sightings. So right off the bat, they were leaving the sightings without an explanation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they were beginning their own investigations, though we didn't know that until years later, but the Air Force began its own investigations within weeks of the Kenneth Arnold sighting. Mm-hmm. And they had a certain number of sightings that they believed were proved that this subject was real. And in fact, in September 1947, you had General Nathan Twining writing a letter giving the opinion of the Air Materiel Command that these sightings are real and not visionary or fictitious. In other words, there's something going on. But that was all secret level stuff that they're talking about. And then the Air Force intelligence carried out investigations over the following few years and always concluded there was something there, but they always ended up saying, well, could it possibly be Soviet? They didn't believe it. They didn't believe that the Russians had made a technological leap far beyond what anything we had achieved. Mm. And yet, on the other hand, they were continually using the Soviet the Soviet explanation to get them off the hook, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They couldn't come out right and say it's interplanetary because apparently they considered that they had no proof of an interplanetary. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have any proof of Soviet either.
So, well, we're at the end of the show almost, sir.
They conspired to confuse themselves first.
That's a shame.
Then they confused everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I hope I can have you on again sometime, and we could discuss more of this conspiracy part of it. I'd love to discuss with you the idea that do you think we've ever reverse engineered, you know, any of these craft? And people are now seeing some of those possibly, but that's for a later show, I suppose. Anyway, it's been a pleasure talking to you, sir, and I hope to get to meet you again at one of these symposiums or, you know, at a conference sometime. But hope to have you on again. And have a good night, folks. This has been, thank you again, Doctor. And this has been Conspiracy with your host, Earl Benezet, and my special guest, Dr. Bruce McAbee. And have a good night, and stay tuned for our next show.